Welcome to the X-Cast X-Files Podwatch, episode 77, covering Closure and X-Cops. I'm your host, Darren Mooney, and with me is a TV editor at The Digital Fix, writer-screenwriter Baz Greenland. How are you, Baz?
I'm good, thank you.
Cool. Today we're talking about two big ones in the middle of the seventh season, so we might just sort of jump right in there. We're talking about Closure and we're talking about X-Cops. They're sweeps episodes. They aired in the middle of the season. X-Closure is written by Chris Carter, Frank Spotnitz, directed by Kim Manners. It aired on February 13th, 2000, which is a lovely Valentine's Day surprise. So, Baz, did you get Closure?
Oh, I got... There was a sort of Closure, not a particularly satisfying one. Closure's a different one because it's very well acted by David Duchovny, but really it's... After 7 years, it's basically Anne Samantha was abducted by fairies. So it kind of leaves that kind of bad taste in your mouth. There's some wonderful stuff in the episode, some very emotive, very powerful stuff. And David Duchovny is brilliant in the episode, and the music's brilliant. You know, there's lots of nice moments, but it does come back to the fact that Samantha wasn't, you know, that all these things about clones and abductions and shadowy men, I know it's kind of all there, but really it's, and she was abducted by fairies, the end. It doesn't, you would never, when you're thinking back to the later season one and season two, you wouldn't think that's where they were going.
Well, I mean, to be absolutely fair, like, I mean, it's not as if you couldn't have thrown a curveball and done it rather well. Like, I think that in the fourth season, like, Paper Hearts, if Paper Hearts had turned out to be what happened to Samantha, I think we'd be kind of happy. But you're right. The problem with Closure is that it's not that it doesn't give you everything that you want. It doesn't, like, it's... The problem's not that she wasn't abducted by aliens. The problem is that we get this really weird sort of walk-ins plot, which is, I think, very late X-Files Chris Carter, because it's... The episode opens with this really Chris Carter monologue. I like that Chris Carter's also an adjective that we can use in this context. But it's got this sort of purple prose about, you know, like, I want to believe that children don't suffer. I want to believe that God in his infinite wisdom does not look down upon suffering children. And it's got this sort of heavy-handed spirituality that really creeps into the mythology around this point. I think Carter's talked about how when he was doing the X-Files, he started out as sort of a skeptic, almost atheist or agnostic figure. And as the series progressed, he became more religious and more faithful. And sort of like more open to religious belief. And the thing that really gets me about, say, Closure is the fact that it's basically, it's an episode in which a mystery that's been set up about aliens and conspirators and serial killers gets solved by God showing up at the last minute and basically saying, well, look, she's had a bit of a tough run. Why don't we take her into heaven and that'll be okay? Which is not... It's not a satisfying ending in terms of what I think the mystery has been set up to this point.
No. And it's difficult. And I think you have to try and reconcile, does it really fit to everything else? And I guess you kind of say it could, because the whole thing about Samantha being cloned as a child, as an adult and stuff, I think you're supposed to assume it happened in those years between her abduction and her actual death at age 14. So I guess you could say all those clones turn up in Redux and Heron Vogue and back in Connolly Endgame. They probably are cloned as Samantha using her DNA, but they're not Samantha. I think it's, I don't know, I think the trouble with Samantha is that, you're right, I think Paper Hearts, even though it's kind of a curveball, it's such an amazing episode, so well done. Had Paper Hearts been the end of Samantha, it would have been a curveball in the same way that Closure is, but it would have gone, wow, that was way well done, brilliant. Whereas this one, it doesn't seem to... It seems a bit naff, I think, in comparison. You know, all the build-up with all these aliens and these clones and the experimentations, it just doesn't feel like it pays that off at all.
Can I ask you, do you think there's something mean-spirited about the reveal that Samantha was dead all along? Because obviously, I mean, earlier in the series, you had this idea... Well, obviously, as Scully points out, the cigarette-smoking man repeatedly told Mulder that his sister was alive. And the alien bounty hunter in Endgame told Mulder that his sister was alive. And even in The Blessing Way, when he had the hallucination of his father speaking from beyond the grave, he assured Mulder that his sister was still alive. Do you feel that after all that, and I think this is one of the concerns, this is one of the issues that people had with sort of the late-stage X-Files, is the fact that, like, it's not that Chris Carter didn't answer questions, because I think, like, the big problem with the truth is not that it doesn't answer questions, it's that it's a gigantic clip show that goes out of its way to explain in horrible depth the how he answered all these questions, is that he didn't answer them satisfactorily or in a way that seemed fair or in a way that paid off. Like, do you think that the end of Samantha was mean?
Maybe a bit, but I guess, I mean, I go back to Paper Hearts. Had it been Paper Hearts, it would have been grim, but it would have been, it's an end. I think in the nature of the constant teaser Samantha, in one way, it was quite mean-spirited to say, oh, and she's been dead all this long. But I guess maybe there's a believability that she's been dead all along, because otherwise, where is she? And I think if you had, unless you were going to start having Samantha turn up as a recurring character, which might have been interesting, but obviously Duchovny was already his way out at this point, so that's hence resolving Samantha's storyline. I think unless you're going to bring Samantha back and have him spend time with Samantha on a semi-regular basis to reconnect and have her pop him at 4 or 5 episodes by the end of the season, then she kind of has to be dead. That's the only way to resolve it and put a stop to it and have him going on and doing other cases. Because otherwise, Samantha has been his quest. So if she is alive and he finds her, then that's where he's going to, at least for a period of time, devote his attention. So, I don't know. I don't think it's unsatisfactory that she's dead. I just don't think it feels satisfactory in the build-up to the amount of the storyline over the number of years, and particularly how they've tied her so heavily into the clones, into the aliens, and all that sort of stuff as well.
Well, I mean, I think it sort of suffers a bit from, like, it was a bit of an open secret that a lot of people working on The X-Files, and a lot of people writing about The X-Files, and a lot of people covering The X-Files, thought that the 7th season would be the last season, because obviously that's when Duchovny's contract ran out, and the idea was Fox was considering retiring them, and even Carter was considering doing a sequel to Fight the Future between the 7th and 8th, you know, after the 7th season was done. And I think that, you know, obviously what happened was Fox had a terrible season under Doug Herzog, where all their shows were cancelled, and the only thing they could do was keep The X-Files on life support, which obviously led to situations where Duchovny didn't want to come back because his contract was up. And I think there's a sense with closure that they're trying to wrap stuff up and tidy it away and just sort of be done with it almost. And it sort of feels like a rushed job in that regard, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. It's almost offhand. It kind of, I mean, X-Files is a lot. They come in, particularly two parts, they come in one storyline and suddenly it shifts quite dramatically in the second part. And it does that to an extent, I think. And it's probably good that it wasn't connected to this Santa Claus killer from the first episode, because had that been the case, it would have been just a lesser version of Paper Hearts. So I think they had to take it in a new direction. But yeah, it does. It's kind of, I think it builds and builds. It almost like it should have been a three-parter, the way it built it. It's like the last 5 minutes. Okay, we'll go see this nurse. Oh, there's Samantha's ghost. Say goodbye, done. And it's like, yeah, that's it. It just feels very offhand the way it does feel like it's, oh, and we're done, I swept under the carpet, move on, let's do more X-Files, and don't worry about Samantha again.
Yeah, it does. It has that sort of, and I mean, the 7th season is populated by these sort of, like, it's populated by ghosts and zombies. For example, the zombies in Amor Fati, the zombies obviously in Hollywood AD, the original draft of Hunger was going to feature zombies, and then Millennium also features zombies. Like, there's this weird sense the X-Files is sort of undead at this point. Like, it's that, like, Carter and many of the people involved would actually want to bury it at this point and sort of, like, put it to rest.
Yeah, I agree. It's such a tired, it's a tired season. I think probably the next episode we're going to talk about is a much stronger one, but generally it does feel a little bit more of a chore watching season 7. Season 6 is quite strong, season 8 is quite strong, but season 7 is very much going for the motions. I think the only thing that really keeping it going at this point is the dynamic between Mulder and Scully. I think that's really the strongest element of season 7.
And as an aside, like, if we're mentioning things that we like about this episode, I actually quite like the Starlight, the discussion of Starlight and the idea how, like, I know that it's very Chris Carter spiritual, but it's you know, the sort of, like, New Age, sort of, like, God and his infinite wisdom, all this sort of stuff. But it's, I like the idea that, like, of light is, life is preserved in light. And you have this idea that, like, the X-Files, if it's going to be cancelled after its 7th season, it's going to go into syndication. So it's going to air on television. So it's very literally going to be kept alive as light leaving the television set, which I thought was very clever. And then you get that nice payoff in This Is Not Happening, where Scully has the same conversation with Skinner, basically, as a nice sort of dovetail, which I think works very well. But otherwise, I'm not overly impressed with closure.
It's the best, David Duchovny is brilliant in it, because I think Gillian Anderson could always out-hacked him. She's the stronger actor by far, but things like when he's reading her diary is so powerful, so well done. And that is, you know, this shows that he was he could be pretty good as well.
And it's another diner scene as well, which I like, because you get a number of those over the show, particularly, say, in Redux, where you end up with the meeting in the diner, where you have this sort of, like, Americana thing happening. And, I mean, Anthony Held is also quite good as Harold Pillar, the psychic, but, yeah, I think it's a very tired episode. So, X-Cops is also a sweeps episode airing in the middle of the seventh season. It's written by Vince Gilligan, and it's directed by Michael Watkins. It aired on the 20th of February 2000, and it's notable for a number of reasons, the most obvious of which is that it's a crossover with the TV show Cops. And it's just marvellous.
Oh, yeah. I love this episode. I think it's the strongest episode of season 7.
I would agree with that by a considerable margin.
Yeah, I think season 7, because one thing in season 7, and you do see this in a lot of shows when they've been on the air for quite a while, is you see more experimental ones. So like Hunger, for example, was one of the first ones from a kind of the Monster of the Week's point of view. And I think this one, again, is very experimental. By mixing it kind of with that, mixing it with the show Cops and having this kind of almost Blair Witch style camera going through it as well. It's definitely something very, very unique. And I think it's probably not one they could have done early on because it probably would have been swallowed up a bit in some of the earlier classics. But here, I think it absolutely stands out. It's so much fun. And I think after closure, it's absolutely needed as well.
It is. It's a much lighter episode. I mean, Gilligan, who wrote this, had been tossing around since the fifth season, the episode that became Bad Blood. He originally wanted that to be an episode based on Unsolved Mysteries that would use Robert Stack and an actor and actress standing in for Mulder and Scully, which I think the production crew might have really, really liked with the movie going on at the same time. He also then in the sixth season when he did Drive opened with that kind of wonderful aerial shot, like this is Fox News covering a car chase. So Gilligan's always been interested in this sort of postmodern twist. And one of the things that I really, really like, and you point this out as well, you said there a moment ago, it looks like the Blair Witch. Like, this is an episode that really, really looks like a modern horror film. It looks like a found footage horror film. It looks like something like, say, The Last Exorcism or Paranormal Activity. It's an episode that I think has aged really, really well, just in terms of like predicting trends. I think after 7 years on the air, The X-Files, as you pointed out, like it's tired in a sense that this episode was pretty much done because like they had no other ideas and Gilligan had been pitching this forever and Carter was like, okay, this is going to be the final season. You get to do it. And like Gilligan's talked about, he went out on patrol with the men and women of law enforcement wearing like a bulletproof vest and it was the most exciting thing ever. And like they talked about how they got real deputies to do it. Like it's an episode that I think Gilligan really wanted to do and I think it works really well. And I think it's also very clever because it kind of captures this sense. The seventh season has this weird sort of like it was 1998-99, turn of the millennium, where you had stuff like in popular culture, you had movies like The Matrix, you had movies like Existence, you had The 13th Floor, Dark City, all this sort of like this stuff that questioned like the nature of reality and all this stuff going on. And even like Carter at the same time was doing like Harsh Realm, which is a show set in a virtual reality. And even in the seventh season of The X-Files, you have this recurring motif of is this real or is this fake? So for example, you obviously have like First Person Shooter, which is set in a video game world written by William Gibson. I think that with X-Cops, you have this, it's shot like an episode of Cops. It just looks like Mulder and Scully wandered in. It's fantastic.
And that's exactly it. Yeah, it does. You could almost be watching. I've seen a few Cops. I remember back in 2000, I was trying to run America. In every hostel I stayed at, the one thing everyone watched was Cops. It was the kind of the thing to watch, and they were all glued to it. And so I'd seen quite a few episodes of Cops, actually, in the US at the time. And watching this episode, it is literally like they just wander in. And I think that's what's so well done. I mean, it's almost a shame that they had the X-Files title sequence because they cut it out completely. It would have worked even better because, and that's what I like about it. It's not really about Mulder and Scully with a cop style camera. It is you follow this deputy, the deputy around, and then he just happens to stumble upon Mulder and Scully down a back alley, which is brilliant.
It is. It feels almost like, and this is kind of one of the interesting things about, like, the X-Files moved to Los Angeles at the start of the sixth season, and obviously they did a lot of location work around the desert and stuff like that. This is the first time, I think, that they've gone into Los Angeles, like the South Central Los Angeles itself, where they're talking about, like, Century City Patrol area and stuff like that. So it's an environment in which you don't normally see Mulder and Scully, and there's a recurring sense that, like, Mulder and Scully, like, on the full moon, Mulder and Scully have, like, wandered out of television onto the set of Cops, which is like a reality TV show. So, for example, there's like the great bits in the episode where Mulder's explaining his theory, and the men and women of like the Los Angeles Police Department are like, "What the hell are you talking about?" and swearing. And even the bit where like Scully has the autopsy, and the coroner is like, "How the hell did you get an autopsy organized within hours of the body being found? That's not how this works in real life." And it's just sort of, it's really, really good and really, really clever. And like, one of the things I really like about the script writing for this, and like, it's, there's this recurring sense of like what you see on screen, because you're obviously watching the fictional episode of Cops with Mulder and Scully, but there's always a sense of like performativity to it. Like, there's always a sense that you are watching a version of Mulder and Scully that isn't actually really, or even Wurtzel, for example, that isn't really like those characters as they exist. It's those characters as they present themselves to the camera. So like, you have this wonderful dynamic where Mulder is like really proud to be on Cops and really proud to be talking very loudly about what he's doing, and he has these great monologues that you can tell he's been preparing in front of the mirror in case a camera showed up. And Scully is like really uncomfortable about the camera until she's in the autopsy bay in her element. And Wurtzel, even when Wurtzel's sort of confessing about like the Bumblebee man, he's constantly looking over his shoulder to see the camera and trying to position himself so he's not in shot. There's like this really great element, and it fits very well with the monster that Gilligan uses, this element of like who we project of ourselves to the world and how what we see of the world isn't always how it really is, which I think is very, very clever.
Yeah, you touched on it. One of my favorite themes running for the episode is Scully, how she reacts, how she she's kind of really peed off. She basically refused to let the cameraman in the car. And then she just she's constantly hostile to the camera people. Then she gives in. And that wonderful shot when they're in the house at the end, and they open the cupboard door and the two men are screaming and she just slams the door back on them again. It's brilliant. It's absolutely, she's got the very sarcastic thing, "Oh, the FBI has nothing to hide," using Skinner's line. But you can tell she is just really, really not happy it's going on, and that's her frustration coming out. It's really fun. Whereas, and little things like when she rolls her eyes when Mulder's going on about, "Oh, it's a werewolf," and you see the brilliant, "What the bleep are you talking about?" You know, you got these real life, like whether they're real or not, they feel like real life cops going, "What are you talking about, you bad man?" Yeah. And she's there, just the side, rolled eyes, go, "Oh my god, what is happening?"
Or even the bit where Mulder's like, "I don't care about looking, I realize you don't want me to look stupid," and Scully's response is, "No, I don't want me to look stupid." But it's a very, very clever piece of element. I mean, even the monster that's used, which is this idea of a monster that takes the shape of your fears, sort of preying through South Central Los Angeles. Like, it's a very powerful, very sort of like, it's a very simple monster in many ways, but it's perfectly suited. And it's a great way to do it on budget, because obviously the camera as an objective observer, in inverted commas, can't capture the monster because it's so subjective to the person who's experiencing it.
Yeah, unless you can't actually have a werewolf. Well, you could possibly get a flash or something in a shadow. That's all you could do. So the fact that you do have this giant beam and you have this, you have Freddy Krueger, it's like they're all there. It is fear itself. It's great, particularly in the environment, which is this very crime-ridden area, which you know, people are generally scared. People don't go out at night. You know, the cops are basically, cop cars are like armored tanks almost, because there's this general fear of what's going to happen. It's a perfect environment for this kind of story.
It is, and it's one of the rare times that you see the X-Files actually visiting that, sort of in terms of, like, in the 6 and 7 seasons when they had moved to Los Angeles, the first time you really see them engaging with that, which is kind of really something to see. Although that said, like, Steve and Edie, we should probably talk a little bit about Steve and Edie, because they are, like, the X-Files was a very white, very middle-class, very heteronormative show. And I think even when you get to the 8th season with the family unit that's formed, that's also a very heteronormative show. Like, this is, Steve and Edie are notable as the first, I think, openly gay couple that you see on the show. Later on in the season, in All Things, you have a lesbian couple, which is a little better, but still they're all very holistic cliches. And like, it's very late 90s, very, very 2000s sort of like...
Yeah, you can imagine one, Jerry Springer. You can imagine when they have that. And I love the scene when Mulder and Scully are sat there. Scully just utterly depressed, sat on the sofa while they're arguing. It's kind of
Mulder corpses. Sorry, not Mulder corpses. David Duchovny corpses during that scene, and you can sort of imagine how difficult it was. It's the scene where like as Edie's like throwing something across the room and being very emotional, and Mulder's telling her to calm down, and you can see Duchovny sort of like crack. You could see him sort of chuckle to himself and go, "Okay, we should all sit down now." And it's just like, Now, to be fair to Gilligan, like, it's clear that they're meant as an affectionate, like, because obviously they're the only people who are in the episode who aren't, like, menaced by the monster because they're not afraid, because they genuinely love one another, and their big fear is that their marriage or their relationship will break down. But at the same time, like, as sincere and as well-meaning as that is, it's still very much a cliche, and it's a nice reminder you're watching a 90s TV show. Yeah,
I do love Steve. They're funny, and they've got quite an endearing quality about them, and they do carry it well. But you're absolutely right; it's a bit of a cliche, and I can imagine there are people watching it who would just kind of shudder to watch. You know, this is not what a real gay couple's like. I mean, I'm sure you all have gay couples like that, but I think generally, and you know, I know from my friends who are in gay relationships, this is not kind of typical of what the general, you know, a typical gay relationship is like. It's not quite this, but not quite. You know, these are proper queens. I think it's very much that portrayal of the time when that's kind of how gay relationship may have been portrayed. So yeah, it is a bit of a cliche. It probably doesn't do any favours. But it's quite heartwarming, so I'm quite fun at the same time. It kind of fits with the, it's all very heightened, so I kind of still like it. It fits very well with the episode itself.
Yeah, I mean, there is a tendency and while this is obviously not too long ago and portrayals should have been much better, there is a tendency to say it is a portrayal of its time in that respect. But I mean, yeah, it's just a fantastic episode. It's directed by Michael Watkins, who is one of the sort of better directors, I think, of this era of the show. And it's really, really, really well done. It was also notoriously cheap as well for a sweeps episode. I think Gilligan joked that he would have been much happier, that Fox would have been much happier if they just filmed a bunch of episodes that looked like this. But it really is. It's probably my favourite episode of the seventh season. I think it's yours as well. And we would both, I think, very, very highly recommend it. All right then, with that in mind, Baz, where can we find you online?
Okay, so on Twitter, I'm Baz Greenland. I've got a Facebook page, Baz Greenland Writer, and you can also follow me at The Digital Fix.
Perfect. You can follow me at Darren _Mooney even. I host the 250. You can follow us at the 250. We're on the Black Hole Media Podbean. And I've got a book coming out about the X-Files called Opening the X-Files, an Unauthorized Critical History of the Original Series. Meanwhile, if you're more interested in the X-Cast itself, you can follow us at the X_Cast. We have a Facebook page and a group, which is the XCast X-Files podcast fan group. If you give us a Google, you'll stumble across that. And then tomorrow, for episode 78, Tony will be here to talk about first-person shooter and thief. Good luck to Tony.
Good luck.
With that in mind, take it easy, and remember, trust no one.